Armin basically just assaulted me right before I went on air, and it's genuinely hard to focus. It's hard to focus on my takes when the producer just drops an atom bomb on you right before you go live. Sometimes I think you guys forget that I gotta be in the right headspace to do this show. You and Mike, with the things that you bring up to me before these things start. Anyway, I got Luke Fox in a minute here. He wrote a great piece on this crop of RFAs, and I'm going to talk about the thing that some people just absolutely do not want to discuss whatsoever, which is the Matthew Knives thing. But I was actually comforted by Luke's piece, so I'll get into that in a second. But I got to tell you, last night's football game was awesome. God, Ravens, Bengals, two bangers this year. The NFL, in a season where we actually had conversations about, is the NFL broken with offense? Do passing games still exist? What's going to happen to the passing game that we love? Yeah, they lit it up again for huge scores. Massive, massive, massive scores. There was a little scare where I thought, oh no, is Lamar Jackson hurt? And then he comes back and he dimes it up. Huge, 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 huge day through the air for him. But also the Bengals, I left that game on feeling confused. Two things quickly before Luke, because I know he's on the line. Two quick things. One is, I watched the game at a bar, and when I saw the final play, I actually went, this feels weirdly different than the game prior that we just went over with the two-point thing. Like, I thought the Bengals should have just kicked the extra point and gone to overtime. They got a lot of their yardage on penalties, and as great as Burrow was playing, I didn't feel super confident in them completing a short yardage play. Like, the Ravens' whole thing is that they get gashed down the field, and I did wonder for a split second if Zach Taylor got pressured at all by the fact that the Buccaneers got conservative against the Chiefs, and it did go to overtime and they lost. So I do wonder if you gave that guy the truth serum, whether or not he made that decision based on a different decision a coach made like less than a week prior. So I don't always love the going for two thing, because in that moment, and I know this feels like the most hindsight's 2020 thing, but I really didn't feel like go for it. It felt as though he maybe thought he was going to get criticized more the other way. There was still some time on the clock. I don't know. I didn't love it. But the actual play itself, when I got back home and I was sort of scrolling through Twitter and I was putting the show together, people were complaining about that call. Like, they felt as though the Bengals got screwed in some way. That was a flop. Like, Mike Gesicki, he hooks, like, the defender engages with him within 2 yards, and then he throws his hand up in the air and tries and falls down. But ultimately, the Bengals ran their final play of the game for a backup tight end, and they lost. So I guess shame on them. But the last point I want to make about this game, because I'm going to do a lot more later with Charles McDonald, want to talk about Ravens Bengals, but man, it was just front of mind after watching that game last night, that terrific game last night. I don't know what this means for the Bengals. They're not fully out of the playoff mix, but when your quarterback throws for 428 and 4 touchdowns and does it with quite a bit of pressure, like, the Ravens were getting him. I think they had 13 quarterback hits in that game to the Bengals only one. I don't know what it says about what your future is. And we spent all this time doing the Josh Allen window conversation, right? And I've brought this up a few times, how I think it's really stupid that people want to close Buffalo's window immediately when they have Josh Allen and he's so prolific and such a riser of the rest of that team, and that defense usually ends up being, I think, more than competent, but good. And we're just in a rush to say, Buffalo's out, Buffalo's out, Buffalo's out. The Bengals are supposed to be that other team that's in the mix. There's supposed to be 4 teams this season that are really there, and the Steelers have risen up and they seem to be the actual fourth team, the real dark horse fourth team. But the Bengals, I can't quite diagnose what the fix is. So I'm curious to hear what Charles McDonald has to say later on the show, because this is a team that obviously needs a better defense. They need a better offensive line. But if you can't beat your division rival either time in a season where your quarterback throws for this many yards and this many touchdowns over 2 appearances, yeah, that's got to be a devastating feeling. And out of all the title contender teams that we've had over the last couple of seasons that feel like they're in the biggest trouble, they're in the deepest waters, it weirdly feels like this team. So anyway, more on that later. But right now, Luke Fox, senior writer for Sportsnet, guy wrote a great piece that's up on sportsnet.ca talking about all the restricted free agents. And Luke, I want to start this way, man. I'll admit, I try to watch as much of the league as possible. I do cover every sport, so sometimes things slip between the cracks. But, you know, I get an off night, and I'm throwing on Oilers, Vegas, and I try to watch West Coast hockey. Last night, I'm watching some of the Canucks game. But it really didn't dawn on me how deep this RFA crop was until I read your article. Like, it is an extremely deep crop.
Yeah, it's funny, right? And I feel like the NHL has gotten a little bit more that way, that we focus on our own market a lot, most fans, and don't kind of step back and take a broader view. So, you know, in Toronto, and your listeners are probably so much discourse about Matthew Knies as one of the preeminent RFAs that needs a raise this summer, and how are they going to be able to afford him, and what are they going to do? But then when you step back, it's like the Leafs aren't nearly the only team in a situation like that. And, you know, on my list, I have Evan Bouchard. You know, him, like the rest of the team, not off to the greatest start, but in the playoffs, he was just phenomenal. And, you know, they won't even really talk to him because they have so much other stuff to figure out first. First, it was Draisaitl. Now, McDavid is going to be available to re-sign the same day that Bouchard becomes an RFA, and they're slammed against the cap, and they're going to have their situations complicated. And some teams, you know, were able to take care of business early. You know, Jake Ottinger in Dallas, huge piece of that team. They signed him once Swayman's number came in, and they're like, okay, there's the market. Let's get it done. Alexi Lafreniere in New York got his deal done, off to a hot start. So it's just interesting to take a step back and look at how different GMs approach it. And a lot of it's informed by how tight they are to the cap, or where they are in the contention window, or just certain GMs are kind of like a wait and see type of guy. Like, I look at Pat Verbeek in Anaheim. He let Troy Terry and Trevor Zegras just linger forever and kind of drove hard bargains with them and didn't rush to sign them. And it looks like he's going to do the same thing with Lucas Dostal, who's taken over the number one job in net, and with Mason McTavish, who's, you know, supposed to be a top 1-2 center in the league for years to come. So, yeah, it's kind of just a good exercise to remind everyone, and even myself, like, which guys are in contract years and how important those are.
So there was a couple takeaways that I had from this piece, and one of them was, as much as you referenced the Anaheim thing, to me, when it comes to really talented young guys, I just hate the idea of doing the wait-and-see approach and then letting it build throughout the season and trying to be more aggressive. And I get it that teams like the Stars have their advantages with their certain players, especially when they've got that, like, real cap alignment with their players. And they go, this is how you're slotting in, man. Like, this is now, this is what it's going to be then. You're not going to really dramatically change things. To have that ability to go to players and say, you know where you're going to fit in, and you got to take it or leave it. God, it's such an advantage, just about as much as the taxation laws. That culture of contracts still matters a lot. But when I read this list too, I went, holy crap, all these guys waiting. Which one of the dudes on the list is not going to increase their stock at the end of the year? And so I wonder if this RFA crop is going to be kind of similar to the Marner year, where it felt like, okay, RFAs are now changing the market in terms of what these guys are getting paid, especially in light of what just happened with St. Louis and Edmonton, where a GM did get aggressive with offer sheets, and it did pan out for the team that acquired those players and really hurt the team that lost them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what we're seeing with RFAs in particular is a massive trend of just betting. Just hedging your bet. Like, we saw it with Brock Faber in Minnesota. Like, the guy gets, you know, he was a finalist for the Calder. He had one great year, and all of a sudden, let's lock him up for as many years as we can. And we're hoping that 3 years, 4 years down the road, he looks like an absolute steal because the cap is on the rise, and we bought him when his stock was the lowest, and he's just going to get better. Like, a lot of these are bets. I remember it was in September, and I was doing some interviews, actually hanging out with Elliot, and Dylan Gunther signed in Utah. And we're like, Dylan Gunther, 7 years? Like, what has he done? And then all of a sudden, he gets off to a fantastic start. He's a really big piece. Scored the game winner last night against St. Louis. And that's a bet. That's a bet Bill Armstrong made. It's like, we see this guy, you know, no one knows the player as much as the team does or should, right? And you're saying, this is a good character guy. We want this guy to be a piece of our team for a long time. Yeah, if you look, he may not even have 200 games of NHL experience, but we're going to give him, put $50 million, $60 million on the table. How can he say no? You know, in a full contact sport where you don't know how your career is going to go. So if you're the player, you're just like, oh my gosh, yeah, I better take it. And the thing is, a lot of people thought Austin Matthews was going to really start a trend on these short-term RFA deals and double, triple dipping. But it really hasn't happened because I think a lot of hockey players are like, that's life-changing money. I may have only played one or two good seasons and they're already offering me this type of security. It would be hard to say no. I don't know if I could say no. I wouldn't bet on myself that much.
Yeah. No, I'm totally with you. And I think that you saw that with the Leafs this offseason. Unfortunately, it was and there's still time for this contract to change and look great. But as of today, it looks like they got the wrong RFA done in rushing to give that kind of a contract to Joe Woll. Because to me, if that contract's done today, for example, he's not getting that deal. Like, he's not getting that much AAV. He's probably still getting that term. But yeah, you see the downsides of a deal like that, rushing to be aggressive, especially for an injury-prone player, somebody like that. You go, okay, that's a good one. I do want to come back to Knies and the crop a little bit, but I got one thought on the number one guy that you listed on this team, which is Evan Bouchard. So
yeah,
this feels like it could be a really tricky one. Out of the entire list that you wrote out, I went, okay, this is the team that's extremely capped out. This is a team that really needs this guy. Like, they're an old team. They just lost two of their younger players. They obviously can't afford to lose this guy, and not like they are going to lose this guy. You outline the case for him, you know, the shot, the age, the pedigree, the offensive ability. But I'm watching the Vegas game the other night, right? And everyone's going crazy about this Vegas goal that they scored, the first goal of the game, right? Did you see that game?
I caught some highlights. I didn't see that.
Okay, sure. Game. Well, then it doesn't. Then fine, perfect. Everyone's raving about this goal, but what I saw in the goal was Evan Bouchard get caught completely flat-footed and be sort of inexplicably lost in the neutral zone, which allows, you know, Vegas to break the puck out and end up scoring. And he's just kind of puck watching. Same thing ends up happening on the game-winning goal. And the discourse that I've seen out of Edmonton and from some national observers is, hey, this guy is obviously extremely talented offensively, but there are a lot of lapses here. And even to the point where I think a lot of people are questioning whether or not he should be on Team Canada's roster for the Four Nations, which I think is completely fair because you don't want to have a guy who does end up being a defensive liability. And so to me, his offensive production is going to be such that it's going to be impossible in terms of a leverage and bargaining position for the Oilers to really bump that number down. The longer they wait, or the fact that they've had to wait this long, seems like it's going to punish them, but that this has the chance at least to be one of those contracts that gets highly, highly disputed amongst fans and amongst people who judge these kind of things publicly.
Yeah, and the Oilers already have probably the most scrutinized contract for a defenseman on the books already in Darnell Nurse. Yep. Who they tried to get ahead of too, right? They bought young and thought he's only going to get better. And you realize he has limitations. And I think they know Bouchard has limitations. I mean, he didn't really take off until they made the trade for Matthias Ekholm. And he had one of the best partners a young defenseman could have in the league. I think, like, probably top, you know, top 10 for sure. Guys you'd want partnered with your young defenseman is Ekholm. He plays hard. He makes his partner better. And so he kind of allowed Bouchard to have his breakout season and breakout playoffs last year. He was a big piece of that. But he does have some things that teams would kill for. You know, imagine if the Leafs had a shot threat, like the Bouch bomb from the point, right? Like many teams would love to have that. So it's a very specific, hard-to-find element. He's young, he's a right shot, you hope he only gets better, but he, like you point out, the guy has flaws, and you just wonder if Stan Bowman is like, well, I already let those other two guys go, and they look pretty good, and we need our youth. And, you know, if Draisaitl and McDavid love having Bouchard on the team, it's kind of hard to tell them, no, we're not going to re-sign him. So it is a really fascinating position that they're in. They knew this problem was coming. They already kicked it down the road by bridging him last time because they were already capped out in the Ken Holland years. And he deserved more money back then. So now he's sorely underpaid for what he can do. But you're absolutely right. There's a risk of overpayment. And it's a really fascinating situation. And ultimately what this does is it puts more stress on the Oilers to get their act together now, especially when you look around the Western Conference. Like, we think the McDavid window is huge, but because of the cap and because Draisaitl's number is going to go up next year, McDavid's is going to go up 2 years from now, and Bouchard should spike huge. It's like you still have to fill out a team. There's a lot more pressure on this year than I think people realize in Edmonton.
Yeah. No, there is a ton. And I, again, as an outside observer, I know like, the record isn't that bad. I think they're 6-7-1. Their division to me is not insurmountable when it comes to them jumping up the standings. Like, do I think that they're going to finish behind Calgary or that they're going to finish behind the Kings? I don't. I think that they're going to be fine. I think they're going to get in the playoff mix. But I just know how I feel when they lose. It feels big. You know, you're like, oof, that's a tough loss. Like, you lost to Vegas. You don't end up getting the point. Brutal. And that just kind of tells you the level of pressure that is on that team. Okay, so to the market in general, to RFAs, it felt like the Leafs had that, you know, the situation with their restricted free agents. It was clearly an overpay with Mitch Marner specifically in terms of the number he got. And then we went, oh, but now this is what's going to happen with all RFAs. But it didn't. And it didn't even happen that year with his comparables. So it felt as though RFAs normalized for a period. And part of that had to do with the pandemic and the flattening cap. And it seemed as though RFAs were going back into something that was a little bit more familiar. Still higher, still more of these long-term deals, but not so many contracts where you went, oh my God, I genuinely cannot believe this one. This is an unprecedented deal. With the circumstances that I outlined, with the depth of this crop, and with what just happened in St. Louis, do you think that this is going to be an offseason? Like, when you're digging into this stuff and you're putting this piece together, are you sort of projecting that this is going to be a year where we start to see the RFAs climb back up into the position that we thought maybe it was going to be trending the year Marner signed before the pandemic?
In terms of $11 million, like in terms of
like salaries that are going to fundamentally change the way we see RFAs moving forward.
I don't think so. I mean, Bouchard is probably the biggest case, but you look at some of the other guys and it's like Wyatt Johnson is a great young talent in Dallas, but they've kind of established a good internal cap structure and it's going to be hard for him right now. He's like bouncing between the second and third line, it's going to be hard for him to command something that, you know, reimagines their internal cap. A fascinating case who I have up at the top because he's already kind of a top four defenseman in the league is Luke Hughes. Now, he had off-season surgery. His contract year has gotten off to a slow start. But the Devils did such a good job getting ahead on Jack Hughes. It's like, okay, is little brother going to come in here and make more than Jack? And there's two sides to that equation. On one side, you're like, well, yeah, he should because top four defensemen who are young and only getting better are so hard to find in this league. We drafted him, you know, top of the class. Like, we need this guy. He's going to be a core piece. The cap is only going to jump by leaps and bounds, and Jack signed his deal back during the flat cap era. And then on the other hand, if you're Tom Fitzgerald, you're saying, well, no, we can't. Jack's our MVP. He's our most marketable player. He's our most dynamic player. We need his goals. We can't have some sophomore defenseman all of a sudden making more than him. So there's that yin and yang. And I frankly don't see a bunch of these guys getting into the eight figures on an AAV.
Yeah. See, part of that though is what you believe to be true when it comes to how aggressive teams are going to be in terms of doling out offer sheets. And it's still a massive rarity in the league, right? Like even the ones that we saw prior, Montreal's most recent one. It's a revenge. It's a revenge offer sheet, right? So, yeah, is your sense in projecting this that GMs are going to be a little, like, it is a copycat league, and when something does work out for a team, normally groups do follow suit. There is still very much a boys club when it comes to general managers, and the feeling that you don't want to do this because, yeah, you don't want to have it given back to you in return. Having to have that cap strike that we were talking about when it comes to Dallas. But yeah, do you think that feel like what we saw this past offseason, where it's a shocking story that always is going to feel like a one-off?
I don't think it's going to be a one-off, but I think a whole bunch of things had to align for that to work. And kudos to Doug Armstrong, because it was really creative and it was really targeted. For one, it has to be against a team that can't match. Like, the Oilers were capped out. Their hands were tied. They'd have to move bodies out to sign these guys. They'd have to pay more than they wanted to originally pay to sign them. The other thing is the player has to want out or be willing to leave. And it was a little bit surprising to me that you have two young players willing to move on from a team that came within two goals of winning the Stanley Cup, a team that has arguably two of the best players in the whole world on it. So it isn't just on the GM. It's on the player wanting out of their situation or be willing to move out of their situation. So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of things have to align. That said, I think the fact that an old school guy like Doug Armstrong pulled this off probably opened some eyes and you know, shook the old boys club a little bit and said, hey, if this guy's willing to do this, to gain a competitive advantage, maybe we should look a little harder at doing it too.
So you have Nye's ninth on this list, and
with an arrow going up though.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, is that better? Yeah. I don't care. I'm not offended by this. I looked at the list and I thought, yeah, okay, maybe you could put him at seven. Maybe like that's pretty much as high as I thought he could go though. So yeah, I don't think it's like an unfair characterization or an unfair ranking for him. But when you're talking about this, it would lead me to believe the way that you're kind of framing it, that some of these teams do have their cap structure in place. There might not be as much aggression because of the circumstances, that ultimately what might end up helping the Leafs here is waiting until some of these deals are done with the other RFAs in this class, because it might actually help slot Nye's in rather than the cap structure, which they've established with their own team, which we really know intimately is not great.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think a lot of it comes down to the approach of the player and the agent. The Leafs players have kind of have a history of comparing themselves to other Leafs as opposed to comparing themselves to guys putting up comparable numbers league-wide. And it's really hurt them, as we know, and it's, you know, we've beaten to death on radio and in articles, but so we know that. And the thing is, signing Nye's right now, I do think it's like he has the size, he has the skill, he has the temperament and the confidence too. Like, he's built for this market. He's like a really impressive guy. He doesn't seem to get too flustered or bothered by anything. He's just a hockey player, man. Like, he just loves playing. He's trying to get better, tries to keep it simple, listens to the coach. The other thing is, though, he has kind of been blessed, right? He's on a great power play unit, not percentage-wise, but in terms of talent. He's playing with the two best players on the team. So, you know, before the Leafs commit, and I do think both, like, he wants to stay a Leaf, the Leafs want him, they're going to get it done. But before you commit, I'd like to just see, what does he look like away from being with both those guys? And, you know, just see how much of an imp- – can he drive a line, or is he a complimentary piece? We know he's a great complimentary piece right now, but just what is the ceiling? Maybe explore it a little more. And, you know, ultimately there's no rush. The guy doesn't have arbitration rights. You know, he's still under – team control. We saw what Brad Treliving did with Nick Robertson under team control. You know, he got him at a really reasonable rate. Different, totally different situation. One guy's taking off, But I'm just saying that the team still holds the power here, and they shouldn't feel, you know, they shouldn't feel like they've lost all their leverage just because Nye's got off to a hot start.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. What I'm going to be really curious about when it comes to how they handle this moving forward is if over the next couple of days, which I'm assuming Matthews misses, right? Like, guy's not practicing.
Yeah,
they got it back-to-back. Just seems pretty obvious reading the tea leaves that they're going to give him this break, that he's going to miss what'll maybe end up just being three games, but that you're not going to see him this weekend. If Marner looks the way he did in that Boston game in the next two, and that line does look like it's creating and Marner's playing with that level of confidence and that kind of, and not that he's played poorly this season, just I thought that he had a notably really good game against Boston, whether or not that will tempt Berube and his staff to say, you know what? I know these guys want to play together. I know these two guys essentially call the shots with the organization, even though we've been pushing back to that idea publicly for the last year that this was supposed to be one of the goals of the season, was getting the feeling of buy-in from everyone and a team, not just as a collection of top-end players, but whether or not they will have, yeah, the courage and yeah, the ability to split those guys up and see what it looks like with Nyes maybe not driving his own line where he's playing with playing without either of those two, but whether or not they'll actually do the Matthews-Marner split and try to keep Marner driving his own line without Austin Matthews.
I'd like to see it at some point. I want to see three lines get an honest shake, like maybe even if it's like a five-game stretch. So Craig Berube says he likes duos, and then he can flip a winger here and there. But he wants to find two forwards that can play together, have some chemistry on a line. Great. But he hasn't had it through three lines. The third line always seems to be a bit of a wasteland. And it's like, if Nylander's with Domi, then Domi looks pretty good. Or if Marner's with Domi, then Domi looks pretty good. But when he's left on his own, he starts to struggle. If Tavares is left on his own at this stage to carry a couple guys, he doesn't look great. How about this for duos? Since Nyes has stepped up, Nyes and Matthews, Marner and Tavares, Domi and Nylander. How about you spread it out that way, and you can fill in the extra winger somehow, and just give it a bit of a run and see if they can actually be a three line team. Because right now, I think they aren't, and they haven't proven it. And if this whole 82 game thing is a dress rehearsal for when it matters most, let's see some experimentation and see if you can become a three line team, because we haven't seen it. It's basically been a two-line team. And then, you know, when the power play is good, great. When it's not, then you're in trouble.
So last one. I'm always torn on this because I think, you know, when you're talking about the dress rehearsal and making sure that you're a balanced team, now having two goaltenders instead of one is obviously advantageous to a team. But it's clear that this season, it feels almost more than ever that the division is there for the taking and that the seeding is going to matter, that some of the other teams in your division don't feel as strong as they have in prior years. So you're trying to stack up these regular season wins. It does feel counterintuitive not to ride the hot goaltender. There has been pretty publicly and also reporting done that the Leafs want to maintain this plan of basically splitting the net. This weekend's easy, right? You play a back-to-back, easy peasy. There's no, like, both guys are going to get the net. Both guys get an opportunity. But what do you view right now, the flexibility with the Leafs plan and net in terms of what the start share is going to look like moving forward if Stolarz continues to play this way or the way he's already played?
Yeah, I'd ride Stolarz a little bit more right now. He's earned it. Yes, you want balance, and I know Stolarz, well, neither of these guys have a history of a heavy workload. In the short term, it's easy because this weekend there's a back-to-back, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, there's another back-to-back. You don't have to get crazy planning too far ahead. See how the guys do in those two starts apiece, and maybe it's shifted. But if we see more of what we've seen, which is Stolarz emerging as the clear better goalie this season, in part because Wall had an injury and was slow to get going, then you ride it for a while. And that doesn't mean overtaxing them to a ridiculous degree or only sticking Joseph Woll in the second half of back-to-backs, like back to the Freddie Anderson days. But it does mean, yeah, you shift it to Stolarz. For one, you can tell the guys trust him. Two, he's earned it. There's also, like, you have to build a culture of guys earning their ice time, and that should include goalies. And you want to stack points, and you ride the guy that's playing well. So, like, I was looking at Stolarz's numbers because I'm doing something on the U.S. goalies.
They're unreal.
You know, he would be right there with Hellebuck and Onger. He's outplayed Swayman. Yep. Like, he's basically number two or three in terms of performances by American goalies. Now, he doesn't have the history, so he might not make the team. But there's a case to be made there for how well he's playing. He's been phenomenal.
Yep. No, he really has been. Luke Fox, you can go read his article right now. NHL's top 12 RFAs of 2025. Latest rumors and reports. It's really great. So, yeah, go and read it today. Thanks, Luke. We appreciate it, buddy.
All right. Thanks, JD. Have a good one.
You too, pal. Let's take a quick break. And what do the Jays have in the cupboards when it comes to trading? Because, yeah, if the budget is the budget, it seems like they're going to have to be making some moves, pulling from some younger players. Kyle McDaniel, ESPN insider, prospect specialist, and someone who spent time scouting in multiple front offices. He's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So the Blue Jays are reportedly talking to everybody. Which makes sense, right? You got to do your due diligence. But it is a little odd given that there are multiple reports from the people closest to the team in this market anyways who are saying, well, just going to look somewhere between 20 and 25 million. Even if they move off of a couple of relievers, it's not as though they're going to get a ton of financial flexibility here. Kyle McDaniel is an insider for ESPN, prospect specialist, and someone who spent time scouting and in the front offices of the Yankees, Orioles, Pirates, and Braves. He joins me again now. Kylie, what's up, brother? How are we doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Always great to have you. Last year, you gave us a great reality check. You know, it was something that, well, it was great reality check because you confirmed my theories, right? that was great. You came on.
It makes me great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what makes you great. So just keep that in mind as we do this interview today. But, you know, we went over the Blue Jays prospect pile because there was all this buzz of, well, could they get in a Juan Soto trade after failing to acquire Shohei Ohtani? And when I was looking at it, I went, this doesn't make any sense. Why would the Padres want a trade package that includes what Toronto has in the cupboards? And, you know, you came on and gave a, I don't want to say a scathing indictment, but a realistic look at what the Blue Jays actually had. And then we saw that Padres trade and what they brought back, and you go, oh yeah, no, they got a guy who's starting the playoffs for them. Of course, this actually was worlds apart in terms of what Toronto could have offered. I want to kind of go over something similar today, which is, you know, you wrote a great free agent rankings, which I want to go through, but Toronto's farm system is clearly deeper than it was a year ago because they were sellers at the deadline. But those pieces, they represent depth. I'm not really sure what they have in terms of high end market, but if we're looking at a team that is going to be limited financially, that would lead you, but still trying to compete, that would lead you to believe that they would be aggressive with their farm system, even though they're trying to build it back up. Where I'm going with this, the question is, how do you think the league now views Toronto's farm system in comparison to when I had you on a year ago? Is it that materially different?
It's better, but some of the stuff that happened since then is Aroldis Martinez has, I guess, either graduated or is like not functionally in the minor leagues anymore. Tiedemann had elbow surgery, drafted some guys like Trey Savage that are something. Arjun Namala had a bad first half and a good second half. So, like, some stuff happened, but I wouldn't say, and then Barrier, I don't know if that was early in the season or the middle of the season when he got hurt. Like enough guys kind of went backwards or plateaued. And then there were some new guys added. Jake Bloss was obviously in the trade deadline. Jonathan Clase was in the trade deadline, who isn't a prospect anymore technically, but is obviously a young player. So I think you probably have to like reach into recently graduated prospects and you would say, oh, it's better. There's a couple extra guys that are like definite big leaguers or contributors or could be considered like of the quality they could have gone into a Juan Soto trade, although I don't think that's exactly what the team's looking to do. It's better, but to sort of get people up to speed on like how I rank farm systems, there is essentially a math problem that like each player is worth an amount of money. And right now I have Toronto's farm system at $155 million, which is 23. Basically tied for 23rd, 24th. I think it was probably 28th when we were talking about it. So it got better, but the problem is the kind of guys that were added were a lot of like 101 to 200 overall in baseball. So probably a couple guys in that range, and then obviously some draft guys just below that in the 200 to 300 range. To move up like $20 million of player value, which is kind of what you need to do to move into that like 15 to 20 area, you have to be in like the top 100, literally. And I think Jake Bloss might be the only guy that was added up there, like in that area. But he also was about to graduate if he hasn't already. So, you know, there's obviously like a little bit of the young player versus prospect stuff, but they basically only added one player at the tier where it actually makes a difference. And he's also about to graduate and become a big leaguer. So in terms of like improving the farm system, like typically what needs to happen is like what Miami did, where you make like four straight giant trades, only adding players, then a draft, then a signing, international signing group, and then nobody graduates for a couple of months. Like that's actually how you move from like 25th to 12th or something like that, which is basically what they did.
Yeah. And okay, so again, this is just like the dumb guy's interpretation of these things. The reason why I ask is like, okay, so you added some depth and it's better than where it was before, but now your hallmark or the thing that you're trying to do is have more depth. You don't really have those top end guys. And so making those trades means that you'd have to remove quite a bit of it. Like you're not just trading a prospect, right? Or like a couple of prospects.
You clear out everything you just traded for and all the stuff that appreciated recently. Yeah.
Okay. So that's an important way to start framing this, because I think a lot of people are looking at this offseason and saying, all right, what are the moves that they're going to make? And there's different lists of what your fantasies would be, right? And some are completely unrealistic, like the Soto stuff. I don't care how many people say that Toronto's in on it. Until I see him actually in the lineup, right? Like I'm at the Rogers Center and I see Juan Soto take an at bat with the Blue Jays, I won't believe even a little tiny fraction of it. But one of the guys that is out there, and I know that they've, whatever they're called, Sacramento, Oakland, just the A's, whatever it is, they've said that they don't want to move Brent Rooker, but he's someone that a lot of Blue Jays fans have coveted, and he's someone that's been in a lot of names. And so I'm going to kind of look at this the way that I did last year with you, with the potential to go out and get Soto. If the Jays tried to get in on a Rooker sweepstakes, what do you think the cost would be from that team, like roughly, when it comes to what they have in the cupboard, some of those names that you mentioned? Do they even have enough?
For Rooker, they would. He's an interesting one in that he has, I believe it's 3 years of control of basically a DH that's right-handed that just had a career year, which is like exactly the kind of guy you don't want to be betting on because he's already 30. And so you're kind of getting 30 through 32, which would be sort of conventionally what you would get of a free agent. Like that's, you know, Rhys Hoskins, for example, like hit free agency as roughly this kind of guy without that good of a year last year. That is doing like that kind of stuff. And so he would be, you know, for the term at which you're looking at, you know, something like 3x15 to 17. So call it like roughly $50 million guaranteed on a 3-year deal, which I think is what he has left. And so then what you'd have to do is step in that process, you'd pay him, you know, whatever it might be, like a $20 million. So the math would then say, oh, he's worth $30 million in prospect value, which then means you have to trade somebody on the top 100 or two guys just off of it. So that would be like Tiedemann plus Namala, like something like that. Like some guys you don't want to trade, but it'd have to be two of them or like the best guy you got. That's sort of the rough math. And also I would say at the deadline last year, we as like the ESPN group of reporters all thought Rooker would get traded, and like Oakland was insistent they were not going to trade him. And then recently they said at the GM meetings that they weren't going to trade him. I think if you take a step back, the way I'm looking at Toronto right now is if you go to the FanGraphs, they have a great website. They have team depth charts. So basically ranks how good the teams are like right now with all the free agents taken out. So obviously a bunch of teams like the Mets, they're going to add like 10 more big leaguers. So they're going to move a lot. And then there's teams like Toronto that have basically $20 million to spend that they didn't have last year, and most of their best players are still on the team. So they're a team that's probably not going to move a ton. Right now, Toronto is in like basically a four-way tie for the 7th to 10th area in the American League, which is a pretty good spot. That would be like just barely outside of the playoffs. But again, if Toronto's not going to move northward that much without drastic moves because they don't have a ton of money to spend, unless they're taken from the farm system, they're sitting next to teams like the Royals, who are aggressively adding already, the Rays, who always add, the Guardians, who obviously went deep in the playoffs, just behind the Mariners, who had a very underperforming season but have a lot of talent. Like, that's the kind of group of teams that they're in right now on paper. So I think really what they need to do, and I think the approach that the farm system was taking at the deadline, is how do we get guys that are going to contribute next year? That's basically what they did. And then how do we make sure that either Vlad is extended, Bo Bichette's issues get figured out, and we figure out what he is? And then how do we supplement what is there, grabbing a left fielder, a DH, a setup guy, like the three or four guys you can get that are roughly about the amount of money that you have left? Like, I think that's kind of what this offseason is looking like, setting yourself up to maybe take some of the bad luck from last year, make that into good luck, and then add some guys. And then in baseball, that actually puts you right in the mix, even though it seems like the team might be far away from the playoffs to some people. If you just turn the luck around, which is obviously something you can't control, but if you did that and then added a couple guys and there was some, you know, Bo Bichette gets better and, you know, some guys that weren't as good get better, like, that puts you in the playoffs, but that doesn't make you a 95-win team, like number one seed. That just puts you in the playoffs.
Yeah, that's sort of the sense that I get of this team, too. The only the only hope I think some people have is, I've talked to people about this, is their way to get into feeling like more of a bona fide contender is if they play checkbook baseball. Like, if they actually were to get out there in the free agent class and get aggressive. Because, yeah, the picture that you just painted when it comes to the prospects is not one that is, hey, this is how you can kind of quick fix a couple of spots and stay under budget. It's that, yeah, you actually might have more at your disposal financially given certain circumstances than is being predicted when it comes to, yeah, the $20 million that you're talking about. Problem I have with that is I'm going through your free agent rankings, right? And Reddit's great. There's a lot of really good nuggets in there. I highly recommend people go and read it. It's up on ESPN right now. But you got to get down to 11 before you could fit just one free agent into Toronto's predicted budget, and that's Yusei Kikuchi, and I'm just not really sure what that reunion looks like. And yeah, so when you're talking about that spreading out of $20 million in this free agent crop, do you, when you put this list together and you looked at a lot of those names, did you feel like there is going to be good value or players that could fit into a budget like that where you're only, you know, working with the $20 to $25 million and slot in a couple of the needs that you that just mentioned that this team has?
So the way you have to look at that is either because you think like, you know, three openings at, you know, call it $8 million, $8 million, and $4 million. So you're getting like sort of two decent answers and one bad answer. For $8 million, sorry, you either get a not very good answer in like a steady veteran, or you get a good answer with a guy that might be hurt the whole year, like sort of the James Paxtons, where every now and then you're betting you're going to get the 170 innings sure. and the four war, but you also might get 20 innings and then you just trade them for nothing. Yeah, like, you, I guess the like financial term would be high variance. Like, do you want to sort of shoot for the moon, gamble a little bit on like a bounce back guy, or do you like take all the money and roll it into like somebody like Shane Bieber and get him on like a 3-year deal where he's only going to pitch half of next season, but then you're going to have him at a good rate for the next two seasons, but he's coming off a TJ, so you don't know what he's going to look like, and that's why you're getting a discount. But that could literally be 3 years of like Aaron Nola. Like, you could get that level of performance, a guy that costs you $180 million on the free agent market. A starting pitcher isn't necessarily what the team needs, but I bet by the middle of the season there'll be a spot open in the rotation for him to take over. And, you know, so you could see, like, if you just think about how do we create value, well, you know, Bieber will be something like $10, $12 million like the expectation of like what he'll get paid that attributes to that year. And if you can get the best free agent starter or the best starter that would be on the trade market for just money and then have him for two more years after that, that creates a lot of value. Now, that doesn't really create like a good, well-balanced team, because I don't think the stuff that we talked about, the left field, the DH, the, you know, the setup guy, you could go get, you know, Kirby Yates just had a career year at 36. He's going to cost $10 or $12 million a year. That's half your money on a guy whose career might be over, although he was really good last year. Like, that's the kind of conversation you're having. Or like Spencer Turnbull had a lat injury, missed half the season, but looked like he might be a fourth starter. You could probably get him for, you know, $7 million a year. Like, he could be that like reliever starter, could fill either role, could be really good. But also he had like 8 good appearances last year. Like, you didn't have a great sample size, but he looked like he was better. But, like, that's how that a guy that you can afford could be good. Or Carson Kelly got traded and only started for half the year and has been, you know, kind of just okay most of his career. He's probably going to get a 2-year deal as a catcher that didn't even play very much last year, but looks like he's probably one of the top 30 catchers in baseball. Like, unfortunately, like, this puzzle is not going to solve itself unless you just get low-end answers or, you know, go get a couple J.D. Martinez's that are just, like, you know, obviously near the end of their career and you're going to run the risk that you're not running into the end of that career, or you take a shot on that earlier guy or that potentially injured guy, you know, that kind of thing. Like, that's the sort of question you have to answer before you then pick the guy you want to spend money on. I, in your position, would be more inclined to take, you know, maybe 2 out of the 3 I would take riskier guys that, like, have an injury issue, or maybe they had a good year and then a bad year, and take that kind of guy and hope that you get it right. And then hope the guys you get on minor league deals, that if it ends up the player's a dud, the guys on your minor league deals can fill in and sort of, you know, keep things afloat until you get to the trade deadline, and you can add, and hopefully your farm system's better. Like, that's the kind of question you have to answer, as opposed to, oh, we got 20 mil. Who are the 3 guys? It's like, what kind of guys do you want? Because, like, there's not a bunch of great answers, but, like, philosophically, you have to decide where you're going to go.
A couple things there. One is, when you mentioned they've got to take the injury track record player and hope that they can fill. Yeah, that was already Kirby Yates. They already did that, and he didn't pitch. he didn't throw a game for the Blue Jays. So I don't think that they're going to go down that path again. But
and to be clear, the Braves and the Dodgers, who are, like, 2 of the best teams at that, they, like, whip on 2 guys every offseason that ends up happening to, and they get to do it, like, 6 or 7 times, so they don't mind whiffing twice.
Yes, of course. But, yeah, the scenario, or what I just pictured, is I need to pay my rent, and I'm sitting at a gas station in the middle of the night buying scratch tickets going, this is it. This is what we need to do in order to pay the rent. That's how I basically just interpreted the situation that Toronto's in when it comes to this free agent crop. Like, you've got $20. Yeah, that's which kind of scratch tickets are you going to buy? The $120 scratch ticket, or multiple and hope that maybe you win a little bit more money to buy more? It doesn't feel overly inspiring what this group has in front of them.
Yeah, like, what Toronto needs is a crypto offseason. Just really go whole hog and see what might happen.
Yeah, you got to have it. Okay, so last one for me. The reliever market is going to be really fascinating for Toronto, because you just mentioned they have all these areas of need, but it's more than a setup man for these guys. Like, they're not really sure what they have in Romano. There's some people that think that, you know, he might get non-tendered given where his arm is at and what the team needs to see from him. They lost a lot last year, and whether it was the Swanson not turning out and the roller coaster ride that was with him, some of the pieces that they lost, like, you know, Jordan Hicks goes somewhere else. They clearly need to add a bunch there, and they've actually been pretty successful with the lottery ticket types, and that does tend to be the way that the reliever market goes in general. But you mentioned Jeff Hoffman, and he's a guy that a lot of people here have thought, okay, well, maybe you end up going out and getting somebody like him. But you mentioned he could be a candidate like Jordan Hicks, who gets a chance to start. And I wonder how that changes the math for the reliever market that isn't overly deep when it comes to those top-end arms.
Yeah, he's a tricky one, because I actually remember, this is how long I've been doing this. I remember seeing him on the Cape Cod League when he was at East Carolina, had, I think, probably the best amateur pitching performance I've ever seen. He was sitting 94 to 98 with a plus-plus curveball. I think he struck out 16 in a game against the best players in college baseball. And that was, like, his coming out party. That's the reason he went in the top 10, even though he was rehabbing elbow surgery at the time. And he's now turned into, like, maybe not, it's more, you know, shorter slider than big curveball, but he's now turned into that guy much later in his career. And so I think the theory is, I know from, you know, being in Atlanta and talking to some of the guys in Atlanta, when they ended up getting Chris Sale and Ronaldo Lopez in a year where there were, you know, pretty generic pitchers getting $16 million a year, they were basically like, yeah, we thought the price for a durable 150-inning starter was way too high. Like, you're paying $15 million for a guy that's not even that good. So we started looking in the places other people weren't looking, trying to find starters. And we found, you know, found what might be a Cy Young winner. And then also Ronaldo Lopez, a very good starter, who might be 2 of their 5 starters next year. And then they had Schwellenbach come out of the minors. Like, that's what the best teams in baseball do when faced with a problem of how do you get a starting pitcher, is don't just go and get in a bidding war with the best teams in baseball, because unless you're the 2 or 3 teams that have the most money, you can't go trade for Jack Flaherty and then sign Yamamoto and then sign Ohtani and just keep adding and adding and adding when they have 12 players that are, you know, potential starting pitchers sitting on the IL. Like, most teams can't afford to get past that, and the Dodgers can. And so you're then in that spot where you have to figure out, like, what you, you know, again, what do you want to do? And I would say, like, looking at the Jays bullpen, I'm like, adding a lefty makes some sense. There's a guy named Jalen Beeks that's a doesn't throw especially hard, but has sort of an average fastball lefty, has started a little bit in the past, goes multiple innings, came up with the Rays, is now into Pittsburgh and Colorado. He's probably going to be like a 1-year deal for $5 or $6 million is about where I have him pegged. And I think getting a lefty in the bullpen that can go multiple innings might be able to be a spot starter. Maybe you get a club option. If he's really good, you get a second year at that same price. I think that's kind of the level of guy you're looking at. The one or the mentioned Spencer Turnbull, a guy that might be a starter, might be a reliever. I think he's probably 2 years at $6 million a year. Might be really good. I think that's the kind of guy you're looking at. Maybe Michael Lorenzen can kind of play multiple roles. Mike Soroka had like a nice bounce back season after being injured for 4 straight years. I think you're going to continue to be, you know, shopping in that bucket where maybe with 3 openings, if you, everyone's in that $5 to $6 million area that I described, then maybe get 4 of them. And that gives you like a little more margin for error. It's not the most exciting thing in the world to be shopping. And, you know, I'm looking at my free agent rankings, they're ranked in order of guaranteed money. Almost all those guys I just mentioned are between 50 and 80. So it's like not the most exciting way to handle that. Ryan Yarbrough, I assume, will come back as another, you know, a lefty that can go multiple innings. Like maybe he then fills that Beeks role for a little bit cheaper. Colin Ray got let go by Milwaukee. He's another guy that can throw you a bunch of innings if you need it, but also has had some success in relief as well. I think that's the kind of guys you're talking about, which is obviously not what you want to hear from the guy that just wrote the free agent top 50. And the answer is, what if you look beyond the top 50? What about the guys I didn't write about?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I can't do Ryan Yarbrough in any sort of meaning. That Ryan Yarbrough was the signifier of, oh, okay, like this game is out of reach now for the Jays last year. So, hey, Yarbrough's coming in. The game is over. If you'd like to go home now, you can. So, yeah, sure, he can give you innings, but those innings are not going to be ones that you're going to be celebrating as a fan. Yeah, I think they need at least 3 arms. And so even when you're, again, going back to that budget, when you're talking about 3 of them and $5 million, doesn't leave you a lot of room to play with this team. So, yeah, it really does feel like it's going to have to be an incredibly creative offseason for these guys that are going to be scratching the lottery tickets at the gas station. Kylie, thanks as always, man. Super informative. And yeah, always feel like a little smarter after you come on. Appreciate it, dude.
Yeah, sorry I didn't give you great answers about Sunshine Those Unicorns, were, but I guess
here's the thing. Those were the great answers. Those were the great answers because this is what I've been kind of pointing to. So again, you agreed with me. Again, ESPN Insider, prospect specialist, and someone who has been multiple front offices. You can read his work at ESPN.com. The rankings are there. They're great. Thanks again, Kylie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Cheers. Yeah, we'll probably have him on again before all this is said and done. But yeah, okay, I got to wrap this up because I got to go to break. I got to go to Charles McDonald. But I am in a similar position. If you listen to the show regularly and you're someone who can put yourself back in the last offseason, I know I do a lot of content. I know there's a lot going on in your lives. But when you look at this, it just, yeah, I don't think that the Blue Jays want to trade Arjun Namala. And the prospects they have, the top-end guys, none of them emerged in as a big positive. So the trade market feels pretty difficult to project for them. And you're talking about, okay, Spencer Horowitz, right? That's no money really going out. And his value is not extremely high. So that doesn't seem like a pathway for you. And the situation I always try to – basically the way that I try to put this out there is the good teams have multiple ways to improve. And for a Blue Jays team that's sitting there with not a lot of money and not a lot of prospects and not a lot of track record with their front office, it's kind of difficult to project what this looks like in terms of, well, we hope it gets better. But that was last year's plan. And as Nick Kiprios once said, which I really love, I don't know where he got it from, if it isn't, but hope isn't a strategy. And that seems to be the Blue Jays strategy as of today. Maybe we're wrong, but it's tough to look at it. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's dig deeper into the Ravens-Bengals game, what this means for Cincinnati and their window, but also a look ahead to the weekend in football. Oh, God, we're way too deep in the season for my liking. With Charles McDonald, NFL analyst for Yahoo, next. So, yeah, I'm still processing last night's football game a little bit. I really like this Ravens offense. It's so great to see Lamar play this way. I think that he's a shoe-in for MVP if it continues this way. I know Allen's having a good year. I know the Daniel stuff is fun. Goff deserves a lot of credit, but what Lamar is doing and the growth that I think that he's had as a passer year over year is incredible. He still has to get it done in the postseason. That's obviously what's going to matter. He's going to rack up 3 MVPs before he racks up 3 playoff wins, but man, is he fun to watch. Man, is that offense awesome. It's great to watch Derrick Henry run, but The Bengals have matched them tit for tat so far this season in terms of scoring. Burrow was awesome. He's getting hit. He's still making throws. Chase is delivering. Chase gives a post game what was borderline depressing for me as a football fan, where he's like, yeah, I didn't expect to be here with us playing this well. I went, yeah, I don't think anybody would. And to have them not be in the playoff picture, given the rest of the landscape of the AFC, feels criminal. It doesn't feel good. Anyways, Charles McDonald, Four Verts on Twitter, excellent columnist, NFL analyst for Yahoo. Hey, Charles, great to have you back on, man.
How you guys doing?
I'm doing okay, dude. So, yeah, last night's game, I guess, are we going to do window conversations with Cincinnati? Like, what does it mean that their quarterback and, you know, best player have now had two incredible performances against the measuring stick team in their division, but fallen short both times and are sitting there with a record that isn't overly inspiring that they're going to make the postseason this year?
It means they need to get off their ass at the start of every season and stop starting 0-2, 0-3, 1-3, because this is what happens, right? This is why people preach the you really don't want to start off 0-2, because it makes it incredibly difficult to make the playoffs from that spot. And to be fair, and not to be fair, but just to be real, like, Joe Burrow was not playing well when this season started. He's definitely picked up his play, let's say, over the past, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. But when this thing kicked off, he looked exactly as he did last season, where he was scared to throw more than 2 yards down the field. And I think that first Ravens game was one of the first signifiers. He was like, oh, wait, no, I'm a lot better than what I've been putting forward over the past, you know, let's call it like 10 games prior to that. So, you know, when before he got the wrist injury in Baltimore, even before that, they were playing pretty timid football. But if I was a Bengals fan, like, I would be frustrated, because the potential to play like this has never, ever been in doubt. But too many times, especially at the start of the year, they find themselves where they're playing bad football, and they start off 0-2, or like I said, 1-3. And you start to see, like, how even for a team that has, what I would say, two Hall of Fame players in their prime, and Burrow and Chase throwing and catching the ball to each other, you still see how hard it is to dig yourself out of those holes. And, you know, I understand. If you were a Bengals fan, you've seen them do it twice, but they start off 0-2, and they still make the playoffs, and they still figure out a way to fight through it all. But it's just not really a sustainable strategy for winning. And obviously, they need a whole bunch of help on defense too, because I think one thing where you've seen the Bengals get worse, and where you've seen Mike Brown's cheapness in terms of his roster management strategy start to hurt them, where you lose guys like Jesse Bates, you lose a DJ Reader, you're not replacing any of these guys that have been good players for you, or even really offering them contracts on the way out the door. And as much credit as you can give the Bengals for finding players like Jesse Bates and DJ Reader and some of the other cornerbacks they've had that maybe got older and they didn't feel like spending money to replace, it's really hard to just solely live with draft picks as your main roster building strategy. You know, we've seen teams do the we're going to spend $1 million in free agency and that doesn't work. I think there's also merit to, if we only build the draft and are really overly picky on who we're giving our free agent money to, that doesn't necessarily work either. If I was a Bengals fan, or not a Bengals fan, if I was, you know, ownership for the Bengals, last night would be kind of a gut check for me, because we have the core of a Super Bowl winning team, but we've been to the Super Bowl, but that team that made the Super Bowl was a lot better. They had one of the best defenses in the league. They were loaded on defense. You've let all that talent dissipate. You still haven't paid Jamar Chase or T. Higgins. Like, at some point, you got to wake up before you close your own window, because these guys are not just going to sit there forever and wait for stuff to get handed to them that they have clearly earned. I think they need to take, like, the entire roster management a little bit more seriously, because you were up 21-7 with 6 minutes left in the third quarter. And I understand, like, the ref stuff is frustrating, and I would 100% agree that the refs obviously missed that call on the two-point conversion, or missed both calls, but you put yourself in a position where you were trailing and giving up, you gave up 28 points in the last 20 minutes of game action. That's on you, man. I feel bad for them. I feel bad for the fan base, but we all know that they're just playing way under potential right now, because you burned too many games at the start of the season. And when I tell you a 1-3 team has to go perfect the rest of the way in order to make the playoffs, basically, well, how likely is that? They start off 1-3. Like, they obviously have some flaws. So, The good thing for the Bengals is, dude, you're one dialed in off season away from being a Super Bowl contender again. You are literally that close, but they still have to do it.
Yeah. You made a lot of great points there. I will say, though, I thought Gesicki was a flop. Like, I was like, yeah, it was a huge flop.
I mean, that's what he
does. Let's be real. Yeah, that was because it looked like it was within 2 yards, and then he made some call. He just immediately threw his hands up, and all of a sudden they're throwing to a backup tight end where I was like, wait, sorry, who? The game's on the line. They're throwing it to who exactly? That's not good. That's not great. So a couple things there, though, too, is, yes, I agree with you that they can't get off to these starts. It was easy to accept those the last couple of years because of Burrow's injuries, right? He had one where it was a couple of years ago where we thought his season might be over before it began, and then he just never looked like the same player. It took so long for him to kind of look like Joe Burrow again. So you excuse that one. This year, it's kind of similar stuff, but not nearly as bad, obviously. But so you kind of have a bit of, okay, it takes them a little bit of time to get going. The roster stuff, yeah, I don't think you can change till the offseason. Well, no, you factually can't because like the trade deadline has passed, but also just being able to coach some of these guys up. When they made that Super Bowl, the defense was so dangerous. The secondary was incredible. It felt like, oh, all they need to do is really tighten up this offensive line and add to this group, and they're going to be here for the next couple of years. And now it feels like there's holes everywhere outside of the two main guys that you mentioned. The thing is teams also that are in spots like this that have had these kind of failures are likely to fire their coach. And I got to tell you, if you're talking about slow starts year over year, some of it's got to be cultural. Some of it does have to fall on the coaching staff. The thing is do they have an owner that's going to be willing to pay Zach Taylor fired money and go out and actually spend money on a coach? I would kind of have my doubts that they would get aggressive and pay someone of pedigree.
Oh, yeah. I think the only way Zach Taylor leaves is when his contract expires. How many presidents did Marvin Lewis see as the head coach of the Bengals? I mean, he was there
my whole life.
Right. Like he was there from the time I was a child to my early adulthood. So
yeah, that's it.
This is what they are. This is who they are. And I think it's kind of disappointing that that's not going to change because I'm fully with you, man. I think the Bengals really need a refresh on at least a head coach. And to start to just get some new ideas and start maybe looking at this in a different way, because the way that I've looked at really this entire Bengals run, which includes the Super Bowl, at least on offense, is like this is almost an entirely player-led movement. Like some of even the plays that they're executing, I wouldn't even frame them as good play calls. But like I said before, like you have two Hall of Famers, a quarterback and receiver, and then T. Higgins is another very good player in his own right, all in their prime at the same time. Like you quite frankly, you don't need elite coaching to go out there and score 30 points, but you do need a better plan than what you've got going on right now. So I think it's really time for them to look in the mirror and say, hey, anything can happen. Obviously we're not wishing for injuries, but we've seen guys not be able to maximize the full window. What are we doing to help them get to that Super Bowl and win that Super Bowl before, you know, they get too old and things fall apart? I mean, and that part is always fascinating to me because I think year over year we lose track sometimes of guys who are like really good and then they just start slowly falling off. Like I would even start to put Roquan Smith in that area just based on some of the games he played this season. And now you look at that Baltimore defense, you're like, wow, we might need to start over and rebuild this whole thing as good as the offense is. And that's going to impact their window and what they could do with Lamar too. So it's all cyclical for all these teams, just trying to get to be the most well-oiled machine that you can. But I don't think the Bengals are actually trying to do that, you know. And that's just and that part I think is honestly just a function of American business. Like we don't actually have to win the Super Bowl to go make a whole bunch of money. Like we don't even have to win a whole bunch of games to make a whole bunch of money just due to the revenue sharing. So for some owners, and I would probably bucket Mike Brown into this case, simply having a competitive team with homegrown players that everyone knows is good enough, but it's not actually good enough for the fan base. And that's a passive fan base that deserves better. And when you have a quarterback like Joe Burrow, who is legitimately playing MVP football this year, and you're 4-6, you should be wanting to change some things.
Yeah. Totally agree. So I did want to talk about the Ravens defense next. Again, it feels weird to go to a negative for this Ravens team right now, but it's hard to ignore it, right? Lamar looks incredible. I think that he's actually a runaway MVP right now. Like that, it's still fair. It's honestly, it's actually not that early in the season. When I was reading your columns and you're like midway mark, I went, what? No, that's not, chill out on this whole situation. Not really a fan of reading that. No, not ready for that. But yeah, he's on pace for me. Like I don't think it's actually as great as some of these other guys have played. I think Lamar is on a completely different level, and that offense is just humming, and they feel so incredibly dangerous. But to see their defense be just like the complete inverse, where everybody can gouge them, where, you know, I'm having conversations with my brother last week going, hey, what are our favorite prop bets? And we're like, oh, okay, well, we got to take this Denver passing offense that's been basically non-existent over, because they're going to gouge that defense. And the only reason that it wasn't a real gouging is because Baltimore controlled the ball for the entire second half. And so I look at this now and I'm like, can I really trust this team as the favorite in the AFC, with all due respect to the Chiefs, when you can't get a stop, when you give up as much as you get?
Well, let me frame it like this. Would you trust a defense that got mossed by Bo Nix on the goal line? Mossed by Bo Nix, not a pass from Bo Nix. Mossed by Bo Nix on the goal line.
You
can't trust this defense. And unfortunately, this one doesn't look like it's turning around. I think when Mike McDonald first got there, if you guys remember, like they played Miami in one of their first games where Mike McDonald was the head coach. And this was a 6-touchdown game for Tua, where quite literally they were not guarding Tyreek Hill. They weren't guarding Tyreek Hill, like giving him free runway to the end zone. And Jalen Waddle had a wide open touchdown in that game too. But they had so many good players at the time, it just made you feel like, all right, well, maybe some of this can fix itself over time. And it did, to the point where last year they were a historically great defense. But now, you see, honestly, you're running a lot of the same stuff as you were last year, but without anywhere close to the same results. They're a lot slower in the middle of the field. Roquan Smith looks like he's taking a step back. Marcus Williams certainly has taken a step back. Kyle Hamilton's now hurt. It's funny because I think, you know, outside of Brandon Stevens, who's struggled this year, the cornerback room looks pretty good. I think Marlon Humphrey's had a good year. Nate Wiggins looks like a breakout star. But everything else is just so flimsy. And then when you pair, we can't really cover anyone on the back end while also pairing that with a really inconsistent pass rush outside of Nnamdi Madubuike, with 3 sacks last night, it's just really tough. And honestly, as a Falcons fan, I feel like I'm looking in the mirror at some of the teams that I grew up watching, where it's Matt Ryan, it's Julio Jones, we're scoring 30 a game, but we can't get a stop at all. And at some point, as we saw, you know, it can come back to bite you. Still thinking about that game 8 years later. But the Ravens, at least they're in a spot where you can say you have a truly dominant offense. And last week, like we saw against the Broncos, even against one of the best defenses in the league, like you could just absolutely buzzsaw opponents. And I think, honestly, in a way that gives them a better chance to win the Super Bowl than maybe last year. Because I think that this offense can really, really travel, and be frank, they're just a much better offense than they were last year. Yeah. Even with Lamar winning MVP, as you get into year two with Todd Monken, you get a Hall of Fame running back who's somehow still in his prime, besides taking like 100,000 carries at every level of football. They still have a chance to win the Super Bowl, but that defense, man, that's the real Achilles heel. And unlike in the recent past, I don't see any shakes. Like, I think this defense might need like quite a bit of a personnel overhaul or facelift in the offseason, because some of the guys that they paid have started to take a step back. And, you know, it's funny because you said, can't believe we're at the midpoint in the season. Well, I'm watching Roquan Smith play last night, and he's getting pressures on Joe Burrow, but not making the plays in the backfield. Or, you know, there's plays in the open space where he looks slower, or he's turning the corner. And my friends, you know, they're asking me, what's happened to Roquan Smith? I'm like, guys, he's almost played 10 years in the NFL. Like, this is what happens, honestly. But, you know, you get 7-8 good years? That's a Hall of Fame career if we're going to keep it a buck. So some of these guys that we have watched recently and covered their drafts, and for me, like, gotten into the business covering, it's just they're getting up there. So it's tough to talk about, but the Ravens, they definitely have a personnel issue on defense. It's including some guys that they've given big time contracts to.
Yeah, there is something more heartbreaking than watching your, you know, your stud players just look washed up midseason. Like, I'm a Seahawks fan, and so I can tell you that your loss to the Patriots is never going to go away, because mine never does. Like, I've sometimes wondered in quiet moments if the last thing I'll see before I die is just, like, the Malcolm Butler interception. Like, that's I see that, and then it's over. It goes dim, because I've thought about it so many times. Every time I see it, I'm like, no, this isn't going to happen this way. So yours is never going to go away. But when you're watching, you know, like, those guys be done, be cooked, like, for me, that was Walter Jones, where it was like the left side of the line, it was just always fine. Like, it's taken care of. And then one night against the Cowboys, it's like DeMarcus Ware is getting home on every single play, and you see the difference between the two, and you're like, oh, my God. But by the time you realize it, it is too late. And, yeah, that is how I feel with the Ravens and Roquan and just that defense, where I'm like, your margin for error looks bad. If I'm talking about why I would say the Chiefs are still the favorites there, it's not just because that they've done it before. It's that Mahomes can have as many interceptions as he has, and his defense still finds ways to win football games. And for the Ravens, it's like you have one path, and that one path is Lamar Jackson puts up, you know, 34 plus points, you know, 35 points. And if you don't get it, then yeah, you're not going to win a game. You have a bad turnover, it might screw you. It might end your Super Bowl run. And so, yeah, I'm a little bit more concerned about the Ravens, I think, than I should be. Okay. So I do want to do one thing from your midseason column, which is you gave a low grade to the Niners, which is fair because the season's been disappointing for them. Like, you framed it well, and the explanation is good. But do you think there's a team that has a better shot at beating the Lions in the NFC than a fully healthy San Francisco? Like, who is that group to you then that is going to challenge the Lions for, the Super Bowl this year?
I think a healthy Packers. I think a Packers team with a healthy Jordan Love will stand a much better chance than they did this past weekend. Because, at that point, I was sitting on my couch saying, dude, put Malik Willis in, because this is just not, it's not a thing. And you know, the weather was crazy, but you still only lost by 10 points to what I consider to be clear-cut best team in the NFL. Or maybe not NFL, because I still think the Chiefs still have a claim to that. But, like, overall, it's definitely the best team in the NFC. I don't think the 49ers have the defense to get it done this year in terms of stopping the Lions. Maybe when they get healthy, we'll see where Christian McCaffrey's at on Sunday. That would be a big data point for them to figure out just where they are for the rest of the season. But honestly, I think if you're not gonna take the 49ers, it sounds crazy because I don't believe in the coaching staff at all, at least not offensively, but I might take Eagles right now. The defense is playing a lot better. I think Vic Fangio has been a big bonus for them because, you know, there's been this thing over the past couple of years, very briefly, and I think Brandon Staley was probably the head of it, where you've had these Vic Fangio lookalikes running around on defense, but the only one that actually can make it work is Vic Fangio, unless you have Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey in your prime, and then Brandon Staley can make it work too. And I think that what he's done for the defense, paired with, like, the breakout from Cooper DeJohn and Quinion Mitchell, the young DBs, Jalen Carter still playing good football. You've got good players up front. That defense has really taken a turn. And then on offense, even with some of, like, the lacking some cohesiveness, I think, with game plan in terms of, like, coordinator strength, quarterback strength. But it's kind of like the Bengals. At some point, you just have too many players to actually be bad on offense. So as long as they can stay healthy, I think Philadelphia might have the best chance to actually usurping Detroit just with the overall talent they've collected and how well the defense is playing right now. It's going to be tough because that Lions offense, to me, they've shown that they can buzzsaw any style of defense that you want to play. Like that Vikings game, you want to blitz us 100 times? Fine. We'll just march right down the field. In the Dallas game, you want to sit back and play cover 3 and cover 4? We'll do the same thing. We'll march right down the field and score 40 points. So, for me, right now, today in Week 10, what we know now, it seems a little crazy to think that anyone could beat the Lions in the NFC. But if I had to pick one team, I think I might go with the Eagles.
Yeah, I got to tell you, though, like, what you just outlined to me made me feel the most confident that it is going to be the Lions that come out of the NFC.
I don't know if I actually believe in them to do it, but no. I think that's the best chance.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But that was the question, was who was that the best chance? And you gave me an educated answer, and I went, okay, yeah, Lions. What can I buy the Lions at today to be in the Super Bowl? Because I actually got to rush to the book as soon as this is done. Okay, last one. This weekend actually kind of sucks. Outside of Steelers and Washington, there's not a lot of marquee matchups. But I like a week like this for this reason, is there's a lot of big spreads, a lot of heavy favorites. And so you know somebody's going to disappoint. So when you're looking at this, who is the team this weekend most likely to have the letdown? Where we go, woof.
This might be blasphemous. And maybe I'm just, you know, I'm looking too recently. But I think the Jets can go on the road and beat the Cardinals. And maybe that's not that blasphemous based on where the Cardinals were earlier this season. But I know they're favored by, like, 1 point. I think when you start looking down, like, looking at this matchup, I think Aaron Rodgers can have a big day against the Cardinals defense that hasn't actually been good. And honestly, with what happened with the Bears and the Cardinals last week, I would damn near throw that game out because that was just pathetic by Chicago. I mean, to let up a run at before halftime that goes for 50 yards in like 3rd and 12, you got DJ Moore walking off the field in the middle of a play. I mean, that was not a serious football team that they put out there last week. And give credit to the Cardinals. You don't always win when you're supposed to, but they did against a team that had obviously just quit in that moment. Now, with the Jets, I don't think, you know, their culture is bad, but it ain't that bad. And Aaron Rodgers with the Cardinals defense, that's still – they do a lot of funky stuff on defense to try and cover up the fact that they just don't have a bunch of talent yet, and they're still trying to build up that side of the ball. And I think Aaron Rodgers and Breece Hall, just their experience together and how they play together, paired with Garrett Wilson, Devontae Adams, that's probably enough to at least go score some points. And if you can just get some pressure on Kyler Murray and force him into one or two mistakes, then maybe you can go on the road and win that game. And also, I also find these games where your season's on the line if you're if you're the Jets. Like, you get to 3-7, this is functionally done, even though the rest of the AFC is just totally garbage. So, you know, a little desperation game. I know it's narrative-based, but I think Rodgers has a big day, and I think they scratch and claw and get a tough dub on them.
I got to tell you, this is my nightmare scenario, is that we all wrote off the Jets. The Jets are so unlikable. Like, who is rooting for Aaron Rodgers? Who's like, you know, I'm really getting behind this guy. Like, no one. Not a human being. Not even Jets fans. Even Jets fans are excited. Like, and I got many of them in my life. My former college roommate, like, he's a huge Jets fan, and he has expressed multiple times to me where he's like, at least if we're done, then the Rodgers thing, I just want to move off of Rodgers. And yeah, they win Arizona, and you look at their schedule that's ahead of them, it's not a murderer's row, right? Like, it's kind of, there's a tough game at Buffalo that they're going to have to win. But outside of that, the second hardest game is the Rams. That's extremely winnable. I don't want to live in a world where we have to be like, should we apologize to the Jets? Like, God, please, Cardinals. As a Seahawks fan, I've never wanted a divisional team to win so badly against an out-of-conference opponent. Like, go Cardinals. Do not be the letdown team. I hope that you end up being wrong on this one. Charles, hey, man, go ahead.
I was about to say, at the very least, I think we can all agree, it's funny when the Jets lose.
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it's funny. Normally you get – it's the Jets and the Cowboys. It's like, how are you such a loser? The reason you're such a loser is funny to us. It's not like there's a reason why the Lions we felt bad for versus these organizations, and it's really not hard to kind of figure out why. Hey, man, I love having you on. Honestly, you're one of my favorite guests in football. I appreciate you making the time today, dude. I really do.
Yep, I'll be on soon.
Absolutely, buddy. Charles McDonald, Forverts, NFL analyst for Yahoo. This slate is not a pretty one. Like, I genuinely was looking at it going, all right, so the marquee game is clearly Pittsburgh, Washington, and I would say then it's San Francisco, Tampa Bay. And after that, like, what are you watching at 4:00? You really want to see Philly play Dallas with their backup in? The Detroit-Houston game should have been a really sexy game. but I can't think of a bigger mismatch than how this feels right now. Detroit, to me, is going to pound them into dust. I've looked at that. I think the line right now is 3.5, which is ridiculous. I bet you that balloons. I don't know how Houston is supposed to defend against Detroit's pass rush. Like, I just don't see how Detroit's not getting home on C.J. Stroud over and over and over again, given what we've seen the last couple of weeks. But yeah, Jets Cardinals is sort of your marquee 4 o'clock matchup. It's just not pretty. I'm trying to pick up the letdown team. I feel like maybe it's the Rams, but that's on Monday night where they're starting to get a little bit of buzz and everybody's written off the Dolphins, and maybe the Dolphins go in there and get a pretty much meaningless win against the Rams and hurt that. But this is like this is a bad week for the NFC West, where you could see the Niners blowing it to Tampa on the road, where you could see Arizona blowing a home game to the Jets and then feeling like, oh, the Jets' season's feeling alive. And then the Rams end up choking the Monday nighter to Miami. And we continue to do this thing of like, all these teams feel sort of alive, but not really. And when you squint, they could be sort of dangerous in a playoff game, but not really contenders. I don't know. That's the best I can do with this one. Cause yeah, actually the easy choice is that the Chargers, the historic choking Chargers, choke to Tennessee. That's actually the one where you probably can't throw them in a teaser. You can't throw them in a parlay without at least blaming yourself for doing it when inevitably Tennessee kicks the go-ahead field goal in the dying seconds of the game and the Chargers somehow find a way to choke it away. But yeah, I'm looking forward to Pittsburgh, Washington. I want to see Jaden Daniels against that defense. I want to see if the Pittsburgh thing continues. That feels like an actual heavyweight matchup, but everything else to me is kind of like, oh yeah, this is actually a great NFL red zone day where it doesn't matter picking out a few games and watching them. I'm historically not a big red zone guy. I believe in my abilities to pick through the games. But yeah, this is one where I'd have a tough time making a case to not fire red zone on. Anyways, subscribe to this podcast. Leave 5 stars if you get a second. It really does help the show. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime. Going to take a quick break, and then Arm and I are going to do a beautiful Friday version of what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, Armando, what did we miss?
All right. Well, quick comment on the beginning of the show. You said a lot of people were tweeting about, it was a defensive holding call and passer interference in the last play of the game. I do want to say, in their defense, because I was also thinking that, it's because the broadcast, was suggesting that that's what kind of happened. And they were saying too many games end this way. So anyways, I just want to back those people up. You know, when the broadcast
I didn't hear the broadcast. I was at a bar where they didn't play the sound because they were playing like multiple games. They were doing hockey and football. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I've seen it, that one was not egregious to me. And Bengals fans will disagree. I'm sure a lot of football fans will. Just that's just not enough for me to go, oh my God, I can't believe they missed this call. If anything, I saw screenshots of face mask penalties on the same play that the Ravens would have had that were more egregious to me. But yeah, whatever. I just don't think that if you're a Bengals fan, you can be crying about the refs with that one. Like, you lost, in my opinion, fair and square.
That's last play of the game too. You don't want to get into NBA territory where they're flailing around on the last play and it's like, what do I call?
Yeah. Don't leave it in the hands of the judges. All right, what's up?
All right. Paul George recently made his return to the, well, he never played in the Intuit Dome, but made his return to the Clippers, Clippers fandom. And the Clippers fans booed him pretty much when he got introduced, every time he touched the ball. And after the game, he was asked, how it feels to get booed. And he said, I mean, it's stupid. I was a free agent. It wasn't something that I demanded a trade or went against the team. They presented a team-friendly offer, and I did what's best for me. There were cheers, and those are the ones I played for. There were boos. I didn't get it. Should Paul George be surprised by getting booed, JD?
This new athlete culture is beyond me. Like, fair enough, he's asked a question, and he answered it with what he feels. I get it from his perspective in this regard. He got offered 4 years in Philadelphia, and it's a public record that he got offered 3 years with the Clippers. Like, I'm pretty sure Ballmer has come out and said that they offered him 3 years and the Sixers went for four and he went and he took the most money. So yeah, like he did what's best for him. When you leave a franchise, and let's be clear too with Paul George, he didn't demand a trade, which is hilarious that that's the bar now. Guys like, oh, I didn't demand a trade. You're like, okay, you still left, but sure, whatever. You wanted to be cheered by these fans. You wanted it to be silent. I don't get it. You wanted to be cheered by the fans of the team that you left and accomplished nothing with. So it's nonsensical to me, the praise that so many of these guys need. But with Paul George specifically, he was always rumored to be leaving. And that was it, is the guy had 1 foot out the door with the Clippers for basically the entirety of that last season. He was willing to leave. He wasn't like, this is my priority. I want to be a Clipper. I'm dying to be a Clipper. I don't know. Am I missing something here? He was a free agent and almost everybody saw him leaving. And a lot of people saw him going to the Sixers. When you leave a team and you no longer play for them, you're likely to get booed. This isn't confusing. It's fun. This is why I love the Trae Young thing the other night, is here's a guy who embraces being a villain and who doesn't seem to have a problem whatsoever with the Heat. And Paul George has always been a guy that has struggled to deal with the Heat. Whether that's the stuff that he talks about on his podcast or has spoken about on his podcast, whether that's been other players speaking on him, where he's had former teammates go, I've never played with a guy that cared more about media narratives than Paul George, who saw media talking about him going to the Sixers. And he's like, oh, maybe I should go to the Sixers. Paul George, I'm not going to say should have gotten booed, because I'm not really into telling fans how to act. They do whatever they want to do. But when they do boo, for you to be surprised or to feel as though you were grieved in some way is genuinely hilarious to me. Like, what are you talking about, man? This is sports. We should be wanting that kind of passion. You shouldn't just want unconditional forever love from every single fan base. It's lame. It's corny. So no, I hate it. My bigger thing is, God, what a, like, it's hard to say it's such a mistake because he thought he was going to be going and playing with Maxey and Embiid, but the Sixers situation, I kind of looked at it as like, don't worry, they're going to get out of this hole. But now Maxey's missing multiple weeks, and I don't think George is good enough to carry a team to victory on any given night. And Joel Embiid's going to be suspended for 3 games, and they're still going to be doing, I would imagine, some form of load management with him because they've been so public with it. Like, the Sixers are screwed. And it drives me crazy too, because you want to know what those two teams have in common? Do you know what it is already that drives me insane?
Clippers Sixers?
Yeah. What do they have in common other than both being losers?
Guys with bad knees.
No. I mean, that is true. That is correct, but it wasn't the answer I'm looking for. The answer I was looking for is that Oklahoma City owns both of their picks. For the love of God, this Oklahoma City thing needs to stop. They have everybody's pick. They've got, it wouldn't surprise me if all of a sudden they were like, oh, actually Milwaukee's pick is owned by Oklahoma City. Like, they have a top six protected pick that is supposed to be conveyed over to Oklahoma City this year, which is insane. And so do the Clippers. The Clippers have one where it can very much land in the hands of the Oklahoma City Thunder. And it's a team that's already deep. It's a team that's already trouncing a lot of different groups. I think that they are and should be considered heavy favorites to come out of the Western Conference. Like, I'm already doing things where I watched the Warriors play the Celtics the other night going, all right, what kind of move could the Warriors make to beat the Thunder? Because I need the Warriors to beat the Thunder. Like, it's a nightmare. That Thunder team is not only extremely good right now, already extremely well built for the new complexities of NBA roster building and salary cap, but they've got so many assets in the cupboard that it's impossible not to think that they are at some point going to make a trade. Like, I get it that Giannis apparently wants to go to certain destinations and Oklahoma City is not exactly like a coveted spot for a lot of NBA players. But if you're Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Bucks, you want to go win somewhere, why wouldn't you want to be a part of a trade to that organization? If you're Milwaukee, why wouldn't you be trying to pilfer as many assets as possible from that team? And if you're Giannis, like, wouldn't you want to go to Oklahoma City over going to the Brooklyn Nets?
Bunk, I don't think OKC would want Giannis, if anything.
No, that's crazy.
No, genuinely, dude. I don't know if they'd want to break up all that good energy to bring in a disgruntled Giannis. I don't know.
Hey, guess what? here, you know how you have a lot of bad takes? this is right at the top. Is like, yo, Oklahoma City would absolutely want to have Giannis. Any team in the NBA today would want to take Giannis Antetokounmpo and have him on their roster. Like, he is one of the best three players in National Basketball Association. It's like, he's like a game changer on both sides of the floor. Could you imagine him and like him playing with Chet and the floor spacers that are on that team and running a pick and roll with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander? Like, no. He would be unreal for that team. He's exactly what that team would want. They have chemistry and they have a fun team, but no, ultimately at the end of the day, they're going to move off of guys to improve the roster, and you improve the roster by adding like a genuine MVP candidate type of caliber. So no, I think if they were presented the opportunity to do it, if the price was right, that they should absolutely be in on Giannis. Anyways, what's next?
Before we move on, I just want to give Norman Powell quick love, because when he was asked on Clippers Media Day about Paul George's exit, he said, "I saw it as addition by subtraction." Norm is averaging 25 points a game. He's never averaged more than 19. And he outscored Paul George, and he had that photo in front of like Nurse, Lowry, and Paul on the bench. So anyways, just wanted to give Norm some love.
I want to say this too. You know what really doesn't get enough credit or discussion when it comes to Raptors land and how they ended up where they ended up? Is how bad the Norm Powell trade was.
Yeah.
Like, an insanely bad trade. They got Gary Trent Jr. and people went, oh, he's younger. And he ended up costing like the same amount of money, but for a drastically inferior player. And the Raptors had Norm. He was having an awesome season. If you remember, he was scoring the basketball a ton. They traded him to Portland and the return was extremely underwhelming. It was Gary Trent Jr. They didn't even get a first round pick in that trade. They just got Gary Trent. And the implication was, well, the Raptors are going to take a step. They're going to be younger. They want to add guys that can be with the long-term core, but also it was the finances. And Norm has just always been a better player than Gary Trent Jr. Look at what the two of them are doing this season. Like, Gary Trent Jr.'s field goal percentage is, I honestly think it's sub 30% right now.
They've been drifting for, like, the trade has gotten worse by every year. When it first happened, I was trying to back up Gary. You know, I've backed him up in the past, but no, it's gotten pretty obvious that...
Again, if you want to know who to side with when we do these basketball discussions, Armin and I, it's a matter of public record. You can search my Twitter account, at JD Bunkus, Norm Powell, Gary Trent Jr. I was very against the trade. I hated the trade.
I thought it was
a really bad trade. Yes, in the moment. One of the funniest things to me was at the time people thought Gary Trent Jr. was this monster on ball defender. And I went, what? How is this a thing? And he's not. He never has been. He never will be. And yeah, he's a really good open shooter. He has his games where he can put it all together and he gets hot. But ultimately, no, he's a very flawed player. And getting him for Norm Powell was like far more inexcusable than letting Fred VanVleet walk to free agency. Like, Fred VanVleet, they got these horrible trade offers from the Clippers and they just said, yeah, screw it, whatever. We'll try to re-sign him. With Norm Powell, they wanted to move off of him. They tried to move off of him and they ended up getting back nothing basically in return in a trade. So no, that was a really bad one. Anyways, what's next?
Let's talk about Teoscar Hernandez. John Morosi from the MLB Network reports that the Red Sox and the Baltimore Orioles are among the teams showing interest in Teoscar. Would it be sad to see Teo in the AL East, or how would you feel about seeing him often?
I don't care if Teoscar Hernandez signs with one of those teams and he sucks. Like, if he's terrible and like plays more like the Seattle Teoscar Hernandez, where he has the ice cold start to the season and then gets hot for some stretches, but ultimately is like a disappointment. This is a nightmare scenario. I think that he will return to the Dodgers. It's hard for me to envision that a team that just won a World Series where he was so important for them, where he came up with so many clutch hits, that they would move off of him, because he's such a great staple in their lineup. But if a team comes over the top with an incredible Godfather offer that he just cannot refuse and he just has to take, then I get it. But Teoscar is a real fan favorite here. People were frustrated with the defense for sure. And when the team was trying to get more mature, I think there was a little bit like it actually reminds me a little bit of the Kadri thing where, there were more people at the time saying it's okay to move off of this guy, right? Like it just was. Same with Kadri. When Kadri took that second suspension, when he buried Wingle and everyone went, okay, enough's enough with this. It's time to move on. But then what ended up happening was very similar to Kadri, which is the trade. Basically, the second it was made, people went, wait, well, we were okay with you moving off of this player, but not for that, not for that return. And both guys went on to win, and both guys went on to have success with good organizations, and you could see how they would fit into winning lineups. And so there's a little bit of revisionist history with Teoscar Hernandez. I do think some people were frustrated with him, but he's like who doesn't want to root for Teoscar Hernandez, right? Like, he's extremely likable.
Yeah.
He hits bombs. He's a fun player, and he is very representative, just like Kadri with the Leafs, of what could have been, which is for the Leafs, having center depth as this team just desperately tries to find somebody else that can anchor a third line for them, which Kadri would have been perfect for. And for the Toronto Blue Jays, it's trying to find that same thing, middle of the lineup bat, the missing puzzle piece that actually strikes fear in opponents that can create an impact with one swing of the bat. And so, God, seeing him in either one of those uniforms would feel awful. It really would. It just would feel so bad to have Teoscar Hernandez returning to the Rogers Center multiple times a season, and every single time he hits a home run, we have to do the conversation again of, oh my God, can you believe that they let this guy go? Like, I don't want to be doing it. I know it's kind of lame to continue to do it, but it's unavoidable if he's on one of those teams. So I root for Teoscar. I don't want to see the Dodgers continue to win World Series. I think it's good for baseball that they are a juggernaut. I think that those kind of teams are just good for sports in general, so long as it doesn't feel like fait accompli like it did with the Warriors. And in a sport like baseball, it just can never feel that way. I'll never feel like, oh, despite how stacked the roster is, that they're definitely going to win a World Series. There's just too many variables at play. But yeah, I'm absolutely rooting for Teoscar to return to Los Angeles and stay semi-hidden, where his games can start at 10 o'clock at night and most people are not aware of what he's doing, rather than having him mash home runs for the Boston Red Sox and seeing him take Chris Bassett deep multiple times a season. Like, no, do not sign me up for that. I do not want that. What's next?
Before the weekend, let's do something non-sports. Toronto police are cracking down on unsafe e-bike operators. So that includes scooters, hoverboards, unicycles, all those things. Traffic officers will be pulling them over more frequently. Have you felt the effects of more e-vehicles downtown, Bunk? I know you live down here, you commute like me. So have you noticed the shift? And do you think like the scooters should be on bike lanes, should be on the road? Do we have any idea?
Buddy, what do you mean? Do I have eyes? Like, what are you even asking?
They're always in the bike lanes. And like me as a cyclist, I don't like them there.
What are you talking about? Do I notice it? Yeah, it's pretty noticeable. There's guys on e-scooters every single where on bikes. Even when you get on the subway now, it's like you can basically rest assured that a couple of your subway cars are going to be filled with dudes that are, I think, doing Uber Eats orders and have their scooters down on the train and are just kind of ripping back and forth because, yeah, it's probably more economically feasible when you're running the Bloor line to be doing it that way than running the gas from your vehicle or even just enduring the elements. There's a lot of motorized vehicles now in the bike lanes. It's obviously kind of a
to me it's just the hopping on and off the road, the sidewalks. Like they're riding on the sidewalks all the time now.
Yeah, no, it's been kind of lawless. And so, yeah, cracking down on it makes sense, but I guess I'll kind of believe it when I see it. And what is this actually? I don't know. Like, it's not, that to me is not an easy solution right now, because you're right. Like, there's so many scooters that are flying around town right now. And it's not like Toronto's going to stop ordering Uber Eats, which is, I think, the primary reason for so many of these vehicles. So, yeah. There's a lot. I have eyes. I meant
like they've doubled after the pandemic, I feel, but anyways.
Bro, what are you talking? Doubled that? Like it's like legitimately you walk down certain streets and it's like bikes everywhere, every single place that you go. So yeah, no, there's a lot. And you're right. There is a lot of unsafe driving because I've been on sidewalks and nearly been clipped multiple times over the last like year. So no, it's pretty pervasive. So good for them if they are cracking down on it. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.